Hi everybody, I'm Shirley. I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi Shirley.
And I feel real honored to be sitting up here tonight, a little nervous, but I'm just going to tell what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I wish I could say it's perfect now, but it's not, nor probably will it ever be. But I can remember as a little kid, my dad always used to call me fat, and the neighbors said I was this skinny little thing with this real long hair, and I was real shy, and I'd peek out from behind my dad's pant legs. And but my brother, who was 11 years older than me, would tease me all the time. And the thing of it was I took him to heart. And so anyway, I would like, you know, my childhood probably wasn't a lot different from other people's in here. Some good things happened. Some bad things happened. Some tragic things happened. I found myself, even as a kid, I really liked food. As I got a little bit older, like probably 9, 8, 9 on up, and I the very first time I can ever remember thinking that my eating wasn't normal was, I didn't know any of my grandparents. They were all gone before I was born. But I had this aunt and uncle that were older, and they were like grandparents to me. And they would always bring me a treat when they came to visit from Omaha. And I can remember Uncle Clarence brought me a whole box of chocolate-covered cherries. And I proceeded to take them into my mom's bedroom while they were all out visiting in the kitchen, and I ate the whole box. And I can remember laying there thinking, normal people don't do this, eat the whole box all at once, you know. And I'm going to say maybe I was 9, 10, somewhere in there. And so anyway, like I said, we've all probably had similar circumstances growing up, and different things happened in our lives, and I found myself turning to food to deal with some of the, at that young of an age, in particular, it was loneliness. We lived on the farm, and my brother was 11 years older than me, and my sister was 8 years older than me, and we didn't have any real close neighbors that had kids my age. And like I said, my dad farmed, my mom worked out in the field right alongside my dad. So from a very young age of like 5, 6, 7, I was home alone a lot while my parents were out in the field working. So, you know, it kind of helped ease that loneliness. And besides that, I was afraid of the dark. And, I mean, I had a terrible fear of the dark. And my mom said that they could always tell. I had this built-in clock that when it started getting dark out, no matter what field they were in, and some of them were like a mile away, I would start out from home and walk, so I would get out to the field before it got dark, because I was afraid of the dark. And I don't know. I would like, for a long time, for years, I blamed some of the circumstances in my life and some of the people in my life for me being the way I was. And that was a person that felt fearful, that didn't feel like they fit in, although I had a lot of friends, but I just didn't feel a part of. I felt apart from a lot. And so there was the fear, there was the loneliness, there was shame, there was all sorts of feelings. And like I said, I started turning to the food and didn't really have a weight problem until I decided in ninth grade in 1966 that I needed to lose some weight. The only way I knew how to lose weight was really restrict. You went on a diet, and that meant eat hardly nothing. Well, like I said, I was a freshman in high school. I restricted enough that I passed out a couple times in school. So my mom took me to the doctor to see why I was passing out, you know. I remember telling the doctor that I wanted to lose some weight because he had asked me, you know, why wasn't I eating? And so he proceeded to put me on some speed in ninth grade, you know. And I maybe had 15 pounds to lose or something at that point in my life, you know. And then, believe it or not, I ate somewhat, quote, normally for about 3 years. And I got into, and the only reason I'm going to bring this up is it is part of my story. I got into alcohol when I was about 15 years old. And the first time I drank enough to notice it, to feel differently, I thought, wow, I have arrived. I was at a dance. I was a, quote, good dancer after I'd had enough to drink. I was popular after I'd had enough to drink, you know, and I just, it was a cure-all, you know, for how I was feeling and had grown up feeling. And so that's all part of my story. And I was into the drinking and got married at a pretty young age. I was 19 and had my first baby when I was 20. And had two more after that in fairly rapid succession. And I got into, like I said, into the alcohol, and then I started, as the years went by, I was into the pills too. Narcotic pain relievers and things like that. And then it was after that, when I ended up in treatment in 1985, January of 1985, and got sober for the first time, boy, did my eating take off. I switched addictions. I went back to the one addiction that I had had ever since I was probably about this big. And I was using food to numb those feelings that I used to use the booze and the drugs for. And I've kind of run the gamut as far as the crazy things I've done with food. Like I said, I started out, I restricted for a while pretty severely. And then after I sobered up, I was binging, but I had all this anxiety and didn't want to gain weight. See, I thought probably my whole life, ever since I was fairly young, I can remember thinking, if I just lose weight, that's all I got to do is lose weight and everything's going to be good. I'm going to have a good life. All I need to do is lose weight. Well, repeated attempts at weight loss. You know, I can stay on a diet for a while, you know, for a while, but didn't deal with me, with any of the rest of me. And so therefore, I always ended up going back to the food. And so then I got, after I sobered up, I got into the bulimia and for about 15 years. And I was also taking diuretics right and left and all sorts of, I did not get into laxatives because I didn't, that just didn't appeal to me. But diuretics, now that did. Backing up just a little bit, I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when I was 22 years old. And so I was on insulin from the get-go. After I started the bulimia, and I didn't even realize it at the time, but when I was doing all that purging, there was a lot of times I wouldn't take my insulin either because my crazy thoughts in my head were, was that if I don't take the insulin, my body's not going to be able to use the glucose and I'll just pee it out. You know, all that glucose running around in my bloodstream, I'll just pee it out, you know, and I won't gain weight. So I used not taking my insulin a lot of times to try to control my weight too. And like I said, I didn't really realize that that was considered purging until I was confronted on it one time. And like I said, I did had those crazy thoughts and crazy behaviors and compulsions and just kind of run the whole gamut. Well, then I went through a treatment out of state and I ended up giving up the bulimia, but I was still left with the compulsion to eat. I just wasn't getting rid of it. So then I really started gaining weight and stuff. And although there were many times that I thought about going back to it, I thought, no, I'm not going to go back to that. And so anyway, as we all know, this is a progressive disease. And food, to me, it progressed, my disease progressed and progressed and progressed through the years. And food became, it wasn't a luxury anymore, it was a necessity to deal with the feelings. I didn't have the alcohol to fall back on, so I fell back on the food. And, you know, to deal with those feelings of fear, loneliness, shame, inferiority, you know, just a hatred of myself. And even, God forbid, to deal with the anger, which it wasn't okay to be angry. It wasn't okay to express any kind of anger in our house because my dad would go into rages. And he was not an alcoholic, but he controlled people with his rages. And the message from my mom was that whatever you do, don't do anything to upset your dad. And so it wasn't okay to be angry. And years later, it was pointed out to me one time that this person said, "You're one of the angriest people I've known walking around." And I said, "Not me. I'm not angry. You know, I'm not mad at anybody. I'm not angry, you know." And until I started dealing with a bunch of issues, and that anger started coming out almost as rage. And that scared the living daylights out of me, because, like I said, I had seen my dad, you know, and there were even threats of, in a rage, you know, "I'm going to kill you, you know, and come after you." And so rage and anger just were not okay. And but finally, through staying sober, it took me a while to stay sober. I would go back out after months or years of being sober and then drink again. And finally, I've been able to stay sober. I've been in the program of AA for over 25 years, and I've been sober. It'll be 18 years this year. And so I have some background into the 12 steps and the 12 traditions and how the program works. And, you know, when it came to the food, I knew that that the 12 steps should work for the food, too. And I kept thinking, now I know what the 12 steps are. I'm just going to work it with the food. You know, and I'm going to pray, and I'm going to... The thing of it was I was saying, I. I'm going to do this. You know, and I would pray, and then I'd end up eating again, binging again. And after a while, I just kind of decided that I probably wasn't worthy of God's help with the food. And that he had better things to do. That I knew it wasn't the God that I thought I knew. I knew it wasn't him, but I just thought that I wasn't good enough for him to care enough about me to help me with my eating. And so fast forward a little bit, like I said, the disease progressed and progressed and progressed. And like I said, the food became a necessity. And my diabetes was more and more and more out of control, and blood sugars in the 600s, 700s, and I just felt like crap all the time. I've dealt with a lot of major depression over the years, too, and so I felt like crap mentally, physically, and of course spiritually, because here was this God that I had my concept at that time didn't care enough about me, that I wasn't good enough for him. So I was very sick in all three of those areas of my life. And I can remember... It was a little over a year ago. It was the end of February last year. And I was so sick physically. And after this huge binge, and I was sitting in the recliner in the family room, and I can remember saying out loud, "Well, I can't stop what I'm doing, so I guess I'm going to die early because I can't stop eating." You know, and I just figured with all the complications from the diabetes, you know, that I was probably just going to die early. And I know it was God spoke to me at that moment, because that thought was there immediately. Why don't you try Overeaters Anonymous? And see, I had tried OA probably about 9 years ago. And having been in AA for so long, and I just wasn't ready, I guess. But all I could do was compare how you people in OA didn't do it like the way they did it in AA. That you read way too much at the beginning of the meeting, and that you couldn't talk. Most people talked on the topic. They didn't talk about maybe. Anyway, this was my concept at the time, and all I could do was compare. But I'll tell you what, I was so beaten down a little over a year ago that I guess I had a much more open mind. I was a lot more willing to come. I guess I hit that proverbial bottom. And I knew that I was literally going to die. I didn't know when. I knew it wasn't probably going to be a pretty death going that way, you know. But that I was probably going to die from that. I know someone in the AA program, and I asked him, I said, "Now, your girlfriend is in OA, isn't she?" And he said, yeah. And I said, "Do you think she'd mind if I called her?" "Oh, no, go ahead. She'd be glad to talk to you." And he was so excited, and having hit that bottom and knowing that I was dying, and you would have thought I would have called right the next day, which, but I think I waited at least two weeks before I even called. I don't know, even when I realized what was going on with me, there was still that, I think it was a fear, and I think probably one of the biggest fears was I was afraid that I wouldn't be able to do it. I came to my first meeting on a Saturday morning. It was at the first part of March, so just about a year ago. It was like I soaked it in like a sponge that day, you know. And everybody was so welcoming, made me feel so like I fit in, you know. And one of the early things that I figured out why I couldn't do this 12 steps on my own without coming to meetings was that I needed to be around other compulsive overeaters and food addicts. And I needed to be around people that did the same crazy things with food that I did. Sick, crazy things. And they understood. And that was it, you know. I just felt like, gosh, they understand. And I could never tell anybody else this stuff. I couldn't tell other people that I dug food out of the trash. I'd throw it away so I wouldn't eat it. And by golly, later down the road, I'd be in that trash can digging it out. I might have to wash off coffee grounds. I might have to do whatever, but I'd dig it out of the trash and eat stuff off the floor if it dropped on the floor, you know. And besides all the compulsive behaviors, you know. And I knew that the craving, talking about the cravings, it talks about the cravings in the doctor's opinion, and that people that don't have a food addiction or compulsive overeaters, they don't develop that phenomenon of craving that we do once we ingest certain foods into our bodies. I jotted a couple things down on the big book here. I hope you don't mind. I know what. I was going to say, you know, it talks about in the big book, the mind and the body are marvelous mechanisms. And it's like our bodies endure what we did to them for years and years. In my case, for 45 years or more. And granted, my body wasn't doing so well with it all, but it endured all that. You know, and I was real fortunate. I was able to go to a retreat in October, last October, and it was a real important time for me, and one of the most important, powerful things I did at that retreat was she had us write a letter from our body to us, what our body would say to us, and she had us write a letter from us to our body. And I just wanted to cry and cry and cry. That was so powerful for me. You know, I put my body through so much. And here it was, still trying to do the best that it could do, you know. And when I came into OA, I didn't like myself. I didn't, but there were a lot of people in here that loved on me even when I didn't like myself. And there was that self-hatred there. And there was people invited me to lunch after the meeting, you know, and I was able to experience slowly but surely, you know, that camaraderie, that companionship. And you would have thought I would have got abstinent too right away, but I didn't get abstinent right away either. I came in March, and in June, I'd been abstinent about a week, and they had a regional conference down in Topeka, and I was able to go to that, and that was one of the best things that could have happened early in my program. And I'm sure I was still pretty crazy as a pet coon, but I really enjoyed that conference. And I saw all these people that this program was working for. And I thought, you know, if it can work for them, and they did the same stuff I did with food, maybe it can work for me, you know. And I got hope, you know. And I was able to get abstinent then. And I heard somebody say one time that she had been abstinent since such and such, or that she had been imperfectly abstinent since such and such a date. And that was another real gift that my sponsor was able to give to me, was that abstinence isn't going to be perfect like it is with the alcohol. You know, with alcohol, I just don't ingest any alcohol. Sometimes with food, it's pretty cunning, baffling, and powerful too. And my disease can start telling me, oh, well, you could have a few potato chips and count out maybe 12 potato chips, you know. Well, when in reality, chips are a trigger food for me. But my disease will start telling me, oh, you can have 12 chips or 15 chips, whatever the deal was, you know. And that was one of the great gifts that my sponsor, one of the things that she was able to give me, was that she said, I don't know anyone that has been perfectly abstinent the entire time. And the other thing that she told me was that to not beat myself up if I had the 12 potato chips. Because being angry at myself was not going to be productive. That I needed to love myself enough, you know, to take care of myself and do the deal. The thing that I learned early on, even in AA, was that this is a program of action. And when things aren't going real well, I need to take some action in order to make some changes. And I've learned that as long as I sit around and if I start feeling sorry for myself or I expect other people to do things for me or all of that self-centered stuff, that it's nothing's going to change. And so it is a program of action. I heard a really good speaker last night. And he talked about, he said, if he becomes, if he starts obsessing on the outcome, then he knows he's into self. You know, I'm going to control the outcome. You know, I can remember I came to lose weight. That was the main goal, lose weight. And but if I had kept obsessing on the weight, I wouldn't have had the chance to turn it over and say, okay, I'm giving you the weight, God. You know, I'm going to do the next right thing, but I'm giving you the weight. You know, so, and he said he knew when he was obsessing about the outcomes, instead of doing the next right thing, that he was into self and trying to control things. And that just really hit me last night. I thought, yeah, that is so true. I thought, you know, that's one I need to file away, because that was me, you know. And let me see, it seemed like there was something else. I can remember it talks in the big book about, as far as with the food, that it was to the point where I couldn't imagine going on doing the things that I was doing and living the way I was living, yet I couldn't imagine not doing what I was doing either. You know, and the big book talks about when we get to that point, we're at a jumping off place, you know, and that there is no middle of the road solution. It says, you know, if you are as much of a food addict and compulsive overeater as I am, there is no middle of the road solution. You know, and it says in How It Works, half measures availed us nothing. Doesn't even avail us a little bit. It says it avails us nothing. And and learning to a new concept of a higher power, whom I choose to call God. That's just my personal belief. And I finally came to a concept of God that I really believed cared about me, that didn't want me to kill myself with the food, and that he would help me. And like the speaker said last night, you know, God doesn't do dishes. We got to get our hands in there and do the dishes ourselves. We got to do the work. But he will be there to help, to give us the strength. He empowers me because I have no power. I am powerless over so many things. And that is the only place that I can get my power. And it's like Barb says in How It Works at the end of that, you know, it says, you know, A, that I'm a compulsive overeater and can't manage my own life, and B, that probably no human power could have relieved my compulsive eating, and see that God could and would if he were sought. And that's where I wrote in, I'm screwed. There is a solution. You know, and it talks about, the big book talks about, you know, that, you know, we talk about that, if I get running a little long here, I better tie this up. The belief in the power, higher power, and enough willingness, honesty, and humility. And it says these were the essential requirements. And I can remember that statement really hitting me. Essential requirements. So we talk about this being a program of suggestions. But this big book also talks about there are some things that if we want a quality of life and a quality, you know, way to live, that there are things that we would be best if we did. So, and it says that those were the essential requirements. Belief in a higher power, because I'm powerless. Step two, that he can restore me to sanity in recovery. And that, you know, and then the willingness, the honesty to look at myself rather than blame other people. And the other thing I wanted to touch on was it talks about my favorite stories in the big book. It's I think in the new edition it's acceptance is the answer. In the older edition it's Dr. Alcoholic Addict. And he talks about as long as we live in the problem increases. If we live in the solution increases. And to me, the solution is this program, the 12 steps. I heard early on that this is a threefold disease, a physical, an emotional, and a spiritual disease. And if I only have one of those things, but not the other two, I'm not going to have the quality of life, you know. And that acceptance of other people, places, and things, and just that basic acceptance of I am a compulsive overeater. Sometimes I want to kick and scream like a little kid and say, but I don't want this. You know, why can't I eat that? You know, and but just that acceptance of that's who I am. And so this program is saving my life. I've been able to achieve so far about a 60 to 65-pound weight loss. And I have a ways to go yet, but feeling so much better. And one thing I wanted to touch on real quick, and that was abstinence and believing that that is the most important thing in my life. Because, you know, and at first I would think, well, no, my God is supposed to be the first thing in my life. But if I'm not abstinent, if I've got my face in the food, I cut God off in a heartbeat. I don't want to talk to him. I don't want to ask for his help. You know, I got my face in the food. And that is my God for the moment. You know, so that acceptance of who and what I am, even though I didn't give my permission, I really am a compulsive overeater and an alcoholic. Now what am I going to do about it? So, sorry I went so long, but that's it, I guess. I'm just glad to be here. The only reason my husband came with me tonight is that he was afraid I was going to talk about him if he didn't come. Just my husband, Jim, in the front row.
Thank you.
Sure, Julie.
What kind of impact has working the program had on your blood sugar stuff?
Oh, my. There's a measurement that they do on blood in diabetics that's called an A1C, and it's the average simple terms, it's the average of your blood glucose over the last 60 to 90 days. And they like it to be 7 or below. Well, when I was really into this disease on a day, numerous times a day, my A1Cs were, I think probably the highest one was 14-something. And after I got abstinent and was working the program, I went back to the doctor after, it was probably about 3 months. I got abstinent in June and went back in October, and my A1C had dropped to 5.7. So it had a huge impact on how, on my blood sugars, on how I felt. It was like there was no comparison.
You're taking a lot less insulin.
Oh yeah, tons less insulin. They had no option but to keep trying to give me more and more and more insulin, because they'd see those blood results and they'd, oh, you know, we got to give her more. Well, I didn't leave them any choice. So I can't believe how it has impacted me physically in a huge way, and emotionally in a huge way too, and spiritually in a huge way. I heard early on, another thing I heard early was that it's a physical and emotional problem with a spiritual solution. And I really believe that. The physical problem being the weight, the way I was treating my body, through no fault of my own. I mean, and to say that I have a disease is not an excuse to continue the behaviors. But in recovery, before recovery, it was like I didn't have any. Willpower has nothing to do with it. Just to say that you're not going to eat, or you're not going to eat compulsively, or you're not going to eat certain foods or whatever, willpower has nothing to do with it. That's our problem. I'm the problem. God's the solution for me. Yeah, Jen.
Can you talk a little bit about the challenges of working to, like actively working to different 12-step programs, like sponsors and member meetings and all that?
What's working for me right now is I've been going to 2 OA meetings a week and about 2 AA meetings a week, 2 or 3. And sometimes I feel like I need more of both, but I can only stretch myself so thin. And now that the price of gas is getting so, we live out of town. We live out by Mead, out by Wahoo. And, you know, I used to complain about that. You know, here I am spending all this money on gas. This is before gas even went up this bad. You know, I'm losing money, you know. And I read in the Lifeline, which is the little magazine of Overeaters Anonymous, this guy wrote in, and he's complaining about the same thing. It took him 25, 30 minutes to get to a meeting. And I'm losing all this money and spending all this money and all of this time, you know. And he said, then I started thinking, you know, well, I'm losing money, but I'm losing weight. I'm losing my compulsiveness, my behaviors. He was losing all of those you know, and the character defects he was working on. God was removing some of those, you know. He decided that, you know, that this was a pretty good deal, you know. And the other thing, I don't even know. I would even hate to venture a guess of how much money I spent on a daily basis on food. And I would make special trips to town just to get binge foods, you know. And I mean, as far as losing money, I'm sure I'm probably better off now than where I was, you know. The other excuse I can run into, which is I tell myself it's my disease talking, is that I don't have time for a meeting tonight. Or I've got this, this, and this I should be doing. I don't have time. And someone said, well, did we ever ask ourselves if we had time to binge?
Yeah.
You know? No, I always had time to do that, you know. So, just blows all my excuses out of the water. So... it's good to see Marcy's smiling face. Marcy was my roommate that first regional conference that I got to go to. And she was even brave enough to put on a swimsuit and go in the pool at the hotel. That just blew my mind. You know, there's no way, you know, but... I was so proud of her. I was so proud of her for doing that.
Has your, first of all, what started your journey in June of abstinence? You know,
I don't really know. There wasn't any specific thing that I can remember. I mean, my sponsor had me doing different things, and but all of a sudden, I had pieced together that week of abstinence, and like I said, went to that regional conference, and that just really kind of gave me that boost, you know, and gave me that hope that that maybe this would work. Yes.
Shirley, I remember you at, I think it might have been the first meeting. If it wasn't the first, it was one of the first. And later that evening, or maybe the next day, you were going to go to a birthday party of one of the grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
And you were like, I don't think I can handle that birthday party. And now you just seem so calm and...
Marcy had very good advice. She said, get behind the camera and just take pictures, 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 and you don't have time to eat.
Especially when they get the cake out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That did help.
Are there any particular behaviors that you're abstaining from that are key by the time of day you eat or the way you eat or the way you eat or...
Yeah, I eat three meals a day. I can't say that I never have anything in between meals because if my blood sugar goes low, I have to eat a snack. But otherwise, I try to stick with the three meals a day. Like I said, I have so far to go yet. But one thing, behavior that I really need to work on is when I eat, I like to read, you know, so I'm not really engaged with what I'm doing. I want to read at the same time. And that's one thing I need to really work on, a behavior there that I know is, because it just doesn't allow me to just enjoy the food. And another thing that at that retreat in October was that she had us, the speaker had us at breakfast the that morning. Well, we had to eat in silence. We couldn't speak to each other. We were supposed to take small bites. And what one of the behaviors I really was aware of that I wanted to do was I wanted to take a big bite, and then before I was even done chewing what I had in my mouth, I wanted to have another bite already on the way up there, you know. So that was a really good exercise in being more aware of what I'm, you know, what I'm doing with food. Even though it was healthy food, I still was kind of getting into that stuffing, you know, big spoonful, big forkful, not even getting the first bite chewed before I had another one on the way. So, yeah, it takes that that willingness to look honestly at ourselves. And that's kind of hard to do. Anyway, it has been for me, you know. We can delude ourselves, I guess I can, you know. But to be willing to take an honest look at myself.
For sharing.
Okay.
Thanks, Sharon.
Yep. Thanks for listening, guys.
Thank you, Shirley. That was very good.